Pro teams have millions to spend, and they don't always spend them wisely. But when it comes to a great shave, you don't have to shell out tons of cash. Harry's saw customers getting ripped off by the shaving industry, with overpriced, underperforming products, and decided to do something better. They found their own way to make beautifully designed razors for a fraction of the price of the other big brands, so you never wonder if you overpaid. Harry's shaving products look great, and the weighted handle makes shaving feel great too. I like to keep my beard neat, and Harry's always leaves me with a smooth yet crisp shave. Harry's quality is top-notch, thanks to German-engineered blades made in their own factory that stay sharp longer. You can get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. And Harry's has the highest customer satisfaction in the shaving industry, plus a convenient subscription option that you can cancel at any time. Getting the best doesn't mean spending the most when you shave with Harry's. Get started with a $13 trial set for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. That's harrys.com/bluewire for a $3 trial set.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Trying to get by Benning. Darnell Nurse left it in the corner. Gets up center. Perry scores! Corey Perry!
Well, you're able to shake away from Solani. It's given away to Solani. Around in front. Score! Tabo Solani with the steal.
Three of the fans score one. Score! Off the floor! On the board! Paul Kariya!
We're back on a Tuesday night, I guess technically Wednesday morning for me, but we get to cover a Ducks win and technically a Ducks loss because we were not live after Sunday's game, but we're not going to focus on that game. Ducks lost 3-2 in overtime to Arizona on Sunday. The only kind of notable news in that game is Sam Carrick scored in his season debut. And Trevor Zegras had 2 primary assists, which coincided with an immediate demotion to the AHL, which obviously has more behind it. And we're going to cover that pretty in depth here on today's show as well. But obviously the game that we're all coming from here is the Ducks' big 5-1 win over the San Jose Sharks. It's one of those wins in a tough season that if they had to win a game, it kind of feels nice, right? Because it's the Sharks are fighting for a playoff spot with the Arizona Coyotes. They had a bunch of games in hand and were only 5 points behind. With the loss tonight, even if they win their games in hand, they can't catch up to the Coyotes, and I think they'd be 1 point behind them. So it's a nice kind of added bonus to a win in a season where we don't get too many.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, like you said, there's not a lot of up moments in this as far as whole games. And so just to kind of have a nice one where they run out there and run over the Sharks is kind of nice. You know, 5 goals is always good, even if, you know, the other coach gives you one of them for free. So, I mean, I'll take it. I'm fine with that.
Boosting the goal differential, even though it means absolutely nothing. It's always nice to shell Martin Jones a little bit too. Just,
yeah, he was having a way too good of a streak, eh?
Yeah, added benefit there to kind of put some past him. But as for kind of lineups for this game, obviously we mentioned out. You know, we might as well just cover that now because we're going to talk about it a bunch. But Zegras ended up getting sent back to the American Hockey League. And we got some much-needed transparency from the Ducks organization, which is something we haven't gotten really ever, right? And when they make these types of decisions, I mean, to be honest, it kind of shows that they knew there was going to be outrage when they send him down. I think the initial tweet that kind of started everything off was Elliot Tiford tweeted out the press release that he got, I'm guessing, in an email about Trevor Zegras being sent back to the San Diego Gulls. And that was kind of the first little taste everybody got. And of course, 3 minutes later, this is the quickest I've ever seen the Ducks respond to anything on social media. They'll make a trade and tweet it out 3 days later. But this was the quickest I've ever seen them respond. They were out pretty quick with a quote from Bob Murray that was explaining why Trevor Zegras was sent back down to the American Hockey League. So I'll kind of read this quote for anybody who hasn't seen it. I'm sure you all have, but this is from Bob Murray yesterday explaining the Zegras demotion, or I guess you can call it, to San Diego. He said, "Our goal is to help Trevor transition more smoothly into the NHL. So we started him out on the wing. He's ahead of our scheduled progression. And then as a result, we are moving him to center effective immediately. He will need some experience in the AHL first, but our expectation is that he will be back with us in the near future and play center for the Ducks for years to come." So ultimately, he's sent back down to the AHL to get some games down the middle of the ice and then eventually be called back up to the Ducks, whether that's this season for a few games or into next season. We don't really know. It's fairly vague there, but we do know there is kind of a behind-the-scenes motive for also not playing Trevor Zegras the rest of the season in the NHL, and that's so he doesn't hit in a crude season and can hit UFA status in 8 years rather than 7 years. So I think if we do see him back up, even if he does well at center immediately for San Diego, it's likely not until probably the final, well, I guess that would be nine games of the season. He's played 17, so
yeah,
he's got to stay under 27. So yeah, just the final nine games of the season, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's what it'll be. I think they'll send him down there and they'll give him as many games as they can. And then, you know, whether they bring him up for the full nine or, you know, they play it at eight or seven or whatever, I don't think is going to make much of a difference. I think ultimately they do intend to try to bring him back up and maybe get him a couple games at center before the season is out. You know, maybe they're hoping after the trade deadline, they'll have some people moved around and they can start, you know, trying to put guys in positions where maybe they see them fitting long-term, things like that. Yeah, it was really weird, I think, to watch it kind of be universally praised as this moment of, you know, incredible transparency and candor from an organization that is just, you know, at times, I think we've said it on here more than once, but like, it just does feel like sometimes like they just kind of have a disdain for the fan base and they have no interest in communicating. And I think you were right when you said it seems to show almost they knew this was going to be different than normal as far as the way that it was received. And so, you know, like you said, they, right away, they had that graphic and all that stuff set up and they dropped it. And so they were able to kind of get out in front of it before it really got away. And, you know, it's funny, just like it kind of shows a level of awareness on their part that it's frustrating that they don't seem to bring to the table more often, which as far as like understanding why they need to address it, why it's gonna, you know, put fans, you know, kind of put them off. I think, you know, him and Drysdale were really the two big things going this year. And so to know that one of them was getting sent down, I think would have been hard for people to take. And I think the way that they have done it, you know, if you want to be cynical and say that it is more about that UFA year, or you want to kind of take them at their word and say it's more about him playing center at kind of a medium level before coming back up, it's probably a mix of both. But, you know, it's a valid reason. I think you can quibble with it if you want. It doesn't necessarily, I don't think everybody thinks it's the right decision and there's some other stuff. But overall, I appreciate what they did. I appreciate that they told us what was going on. And I don't disagree with the plan in so far as the underlying thought process.
Yeah, I think it's one of the smartest, if not maybe the only smart move the Ducks organization has made in terms of handling Trevor Zegras this season. That might be a bit tough, but there has been some concerns among the fan base on how they've handled his minutes and his role in some games in terms of protecting him a little bit too much. But this is one of those decisions that, you know, before you hear the reasoning, there's obviously a lot of concern. And I think, you know, right away, a lot of fans kind of snap back saying, well, what, you know, this guy just put up two primary assists the last night. It looked like the Ducks' best player. And then all of a sudden gets sent back down to San Diego. But then the reasoning comes out and it really is one you can't argue with, right? I mean, the last thing you want to do for this kid, I think, if you're planning on developing him as a center, is throw him right down the middle of the ice at the NHL after playing him on the wing for the last couple games here, or for, I guess, the first 17 games of his NHL career. And then, bam, you're right down the middle here. We're not going to give you kind of a runway. You're thrown right into the fire. So sending him back down to San Diego, giving him some time to adjust, get used to playing center again, on a full-time basis. Last time he did that was at BU. So it's been a little bit, not forever, but it's been a while since he's played down the middle of the ice, and it'll be some stiffer competition than he was used to at the NCAA level. So, you know, give him a couple games to adjust. And I think on the other side of that agenda, that accrued season does kind of come into play here, and you can kind of kill two birds with one stone if you're the Ducks organization here and say, you know, on the surface, you're saying, oh, you're sending him down to San Diego to transition him to center, and we don't want to throw him into the fire here at the NHL level. And, oh, well, it just so happens, you know, we're going to keep him down there until there's only 9 games left in the season or so, and call him back up if he's ready. And, you know, oh, he just slid under the 27-game mark and doesn't hit the accrued season. So, you know, at the end, they kind of get what they want without really angering the fan base too much, because now you can't really argue that accrued season, you know, factor that we were arguing a couple weeks ago, right? Where we were saying, okay, this is ridiculous. Just play the kid. Who cares if he hits UFA status 1 year earlier or 1 year later? And now, you know, they've kind of got this fallback option here to say, oh, you know, well, we want to move him to center ice. And it's such a logical reason for sending him back down. You can't sit there and really say, oh, well, that's a dumb decision.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing they did, right? Is they kind of gave themselves a little bit of cover when they praised him, and they're like, oh, he's actually well ahead of our expectations. And so, you know, we weren't expecting to want to put him at center here. We were going to let him play out the season at winger, you know, is kind of the undertone. And they're like, so we're going to send him down back, and hopefully we can have him up by the end of the season. And, you know, exactly like you said, it just so happens, you know, when the season's over, he's going to play 23, 24 games or whatever it is. And yeah, like, I don't mind it. I think it's, you know, I think to a certain extent, you know, we kind of saw this take place over a couple years with Isaac Lundstrom, right? Where he would come up and he would kind of shift to the wing on a fourth or third line role. And then he would go down and he would kind of work on his game playing at center in San Diego or overseas. And then, you know, this year we'd seen him and he seems to have really matured into an NHL center. And so it makes sense that they would be handling Zegras the exact same way as far as that kind of process of allowing him to see what the NHL game is like and have an opportunity when he goes back down to learn center to kind of have in the back of his mind, you know, what it's like at the next level. You know, I think that gives him a little bit of that advantage that we talked about before with like having a little bit of taste of what it's like. So,
yeah, they've definitely taken a more protective approach with Trevor Zegras than they have with some of their prospects in the past, right? Where Isaac Lindstrom was thrown down the middle for his original, I think, 7 or 9 game stint and played center for all, you know, every single one of those games, and has played center pretty much every game since, except a few games where he shifted to the wing to make way for other guys to play up the middle. Sam Steele, since his NHL debut, came in as a center. They played him at center, and just like Lindstrom, a few times he's been shifted to the wing to kind of make way for some other guys to play down the middle. But Zegras has taken a different approach that we haven't seen from the Ducks organization, where they're starting him on the wing to kind of ease his way in to the NHL, and then saying, okay, now we're going to send him back down to the AHL. It's not because he's playing bad, but because we want to, you know, give him a bit of a transition period here to move back to the center of the ice. And honestly, I don't expect that to be a long transition for Trevor Zegras. This isn't like it's a kid who's been playing on the wing for his entire career, and then all of a sudden you want to move him to center, and he's got to learn how to play center and learn the game, and kind of you know, learn those responsibilities of being a player who plays at the middle of the ice. This is a guy who was drafted as a center, you know, played as a center for, you know, various times with the United States National Team Development Program, played as a center with Boston University. So this is a guy who is, you know, born and bred as a center. Just so happens he can get it done as a winger too. So I don't expect that transition to take long. There might be a few games of rust just so he kind of gets used to some of those defensive responsibilities, taking draws again against some tougher opposition. But I'd imagine, you know, 3 or 4 games into his AHL assignment here that, you know, we're seeing a more comfortable Trevor Zegras up the middle of the ice. And I mean, just knowing the way he torched the AHL when he was down there last time, the way he's been playing with the Ducks as of late, the offensive flair and the talent isn't going anywhere. It's just going to be that adjustment again to some of the responsibilities of playing down the middle. That might take him a bit here, but it's going to be hard to keep him down there long, right? I know the accrued season thing kind of comes into it, but at some point he, again, just like we said at the beginning of the season here, he's going to be knocking on the door again and playing his way back into the lineup.
Yeah, I think, you know, like you said, I think every time, you know, you talk about someone playing center or playing wing and what the difference is, they always talk about, you know, the defensive runs responsibilities and making sure that you're like the first man back or the high man, you know, in the zone and things like that. And I think one of the things that I'm kind of excited for is to see if he can use that high level hockey IQ to affect the game defensively, right? You know, kind of use his position a little bit more center in the ice to be able to like read plays and things like that. And maybe, you know, kind of cut breakouts off before they start or anything like that. I just think it'll be interesting to see if he's able to use his hockey IQ to help him be an effective player defensively, and how, you know, that might be a little bit more of an attacking thing than a defending thing, just based on his ability to jump plays in the neutral zone or in the defensive zone. So I just think it'll be interesting to see how that happens. But yeah, I don't think it'll take him very long.
No, I could imagine. Again, it would be different if they were trying to, let's say, convert Ricard Raquel back to center ice, or, you know, convert Jacob Perreault to a center. I know he's played center on occasion. He's done pretty well at it, but he's been primarily a winger throughout his career. It's a bit of a different transition at that point. But with Zegras, it's a guy who, you know, up until basically this year was playing primarily center. At the World Junior Championship this year, where he dominated, he was playing as a center, occasionally on the wing. But he's just one of those versatile players where if you have some guys who can really only play down the middle of the ice, sure, you can shift him to wing. And I'm sure we'll see that throughout Trevor Zegras' career. But it's clear that the Ducks want him to be a center. And this kind of clears up a question we had going into this year that, you know, we have looked at the development path of a lot of Ducks prospects and said, okay, well, if they want to use him as a center, they're going to use him as a center right away, because that's the path we've seen with Ricard Raquel and Sam Steele and, you know, Isaac Lindstrom, and, you know, keep dating back to Duck centers, you know, Ryan Getzlaf. And I think this is a notable shift in their development of players, and especially, you know, some of their top prospects, that they're willing to maybe, I don't want to say adjust, but yeah, you know, adjust their development process for these types of guys, where now, you know, maybe Trevor Zegras is unique and we don't see this again, but it is kind of a shift of how they've developed centers in the past. And we'll have to see how that pans out for them. But I think Trevor Zegras is definitely a unique talent where it's hard to say if this is kind of an approach that they're going to take moving forward, and one that, you know, we have to get some more Trevor Zegras like forwards in the system to see how they handle the development, because we really haven't had a forward of this kind of capacity and capability since Bobby Ryan. And I know you've mentioned that a few times in the past.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, you, like you said, we talked about it a bunch, and the degree that we thought, you know, when he first came up and he was playing on the wing, I got a little anxious that he was going to really end up just staying out there on the wing. And, you know, his offensive talent is so high that I don't know that there's any part of it. I don't know. let me say this. I don't know that it's, other than in the, this could sound funny, but other than in like kind of the classic way that we think about these things, I'm not always certain how much being a center means, right? Because we have heard a little bit the conversation change to being less about center and wing, but more about F1, F2, F3, and, you know, kind of looking at the forward group as a whole and more about being situational with, like, when you see you're the third guy in, this is your responsibility. But we also know that the Ducks are a more traditional organization with how they do things and how they view things. And so him being sent out there, especially with there being some conversation about his size and his ability to kind of hold up to physical play, I do wonder if that was the whole point of this first bit. Like, maybe we do need to give the Ducks organization a little bit credit for just being like, look, let's just throw him up there at wing and see how he does. And we'll get a pretty good idea pretty quick if we think we can move him to the center. And if so, then maybe we can whatever, you know. And to your point, it might just be that they recognized his ability and they understand why he's different than some of the more some of the picks they've had recently, like Steele or Larson or Lundstrom and things like that, and the way that they've handled those players. And so, yeah, I think we probably won't know until a year or two and we get an idea with maybe some of these last recent picks and then whatever pick that we make in the lottery this year and see the way that they handle those guys who should have that kind of assumed high level.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the top end of this year's draft, if they take a, you know, a Manny Beniers or Kent Johnson, who both play for Michigan, Beniers is more of a center but has played wing in the past, and Johnson's more of a winger who's played center in the past, and it will be interesting to see, you know, a guy at that kind of draft level in terms of where they went and as a top 10 pick and how they'll develop those guys going forward, because, you know, we've only seen two examples. We've seen Zegras as a forward and Drysdale as a defenseman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, prior to that, it was Bobby Ryan as a forward and Hampus Lindholm as a defenseman as top picks and how they developed those guys. So we have, you know, at least one this year, if not another next year and beyond here, and to kind of see how they're going to approach developing those guys. And, you know, we've speculated this at numerous times this year on a new GM and a new head coach, and the way they develop Zegras and Drysdale this year could mean nothing, you know, a couple of years down the road with a new general manager and a new head coach and a new approach to developing, you know, those young players. So you can take it as a case by case basis at this point. It'll be fun at the very least to see Trevor Zegras back in San Diego. I know a lot of people joked when that news came out that they'll actually be able to get some use out of their AHL TV subscriptions now that Zegras and Drysdale both got called up and weren't playing down there. So there wasn't a lot of guys to watch. And Jacob Perreault was out of the lineup injured until just this last weekend. So to have Zegras back down there, Perreault healthy, and he has 4 points in his last two games, and, you know, them at least playing together on the power play, if not on a line together, will be fun to kind of watch that future pairing that I know a lot of people are excited to watch, of, you know, a dynamic playmaking center like Trevor Zegras and a, you know, a really lethal goal scoring winger like Jacob Perreault. So at the very least, you know, it does.
Oh, you kind were of talking about Hunter Drew?
Yeah, Hunter Drew. We had to throw him in there too. What about a line of Perreault, Zegras, and Hunter Drew?
Let's do it. Are you kidding me? Hunter Drew basically turns into the Dustin Penner of that line. And last time we had that, it worked out all right. I guess the time before that, because he did have a second stint that didn't go quite as well.
I think this kind of plays into another topic that we want to discuss here. I was going to go into the Getzlaf retirement stuff, but we'll get to that after here, because a lot of people were talking about the Josh Manson trade rumors that kind of came out a little bit today. And, you know, it's funny talking about Hunter Drew playing on the wing because the Gulls have so many defensemen, but Axel Andersson comes over from Sweden, so they get another defenseman down in San Diego with two, I mean, you could argue two NHL quality defensemen already down in San Diego with Josh Mahura and Brandon Gouley, and a big logjam of defensemen up in the Ducks lineup already.
Could you argue? Are we 100% sure that Brandon Gouley?
Yeah, I want to say
he's an NHL caliber defenseman.
Maybe not NHL caliber, but guys who have had NHL experience or considerable NHL experience, you know, more than a couple of games here or there, like Simon Benoit has had, and a few other guys down there. Like, these are guys who have been up for, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20 games, if not more, I think, in Brendan Gulley's case. So you do kind of have this logjam of defensemen, where it doesn't mean you have to make a trade, but you've got another one coming over from Sweden right now, who's going to be wanting to get some ice time. And I'm sure the San Diego coaching staff and the Ducks organization are going to want him to get some playing time here. And, you know, with the rumors swirling around a lot of the Ducks forwards and roster players, it's no surprise that Josh Manson's name has kind of jumped back into the discussion here. Nothing really concrete. It's fairly similar to the Josh Manson rumors we've heard over the years, basically, mm-hmm. that he's someone to watch. Interest is picked up. You know, he's got that one more year left on his contract. It's a pretty easy contract for the Ducks to eat salary on and not really be hurt on it for longer than just the end of this year and next year. And that the Ducks are looking for kind of young NHL-ready assets, which is something we've heard about, you know, four or five mm-hmm. times this season so far. So it is nothing new. But then, you know, that was from the fourth period, that quote I was mentioning there. And then LeBron on Insider Trading reported also that the Ducks are listening to offers on Josh Manson. And, of course, as we've heard, again, 100 times, that they really like him. It's not a guy that they are actively shopping, but they're just listening to offers. And the price, just like it is on Rickard Rakell, is fairly high. And I think he quoted a first-round pick and a top prospect as kind of the starting point for a discussion for Josh Manson, and that the Winnipeg Jets and the Carolina Hurricanes were interested in him. Whether they're interested at that price or not, that's not something that was discussed, but that is a lot. You know, Josh Manson is a great defenseman. Don't get me wrong. And, you know, he's had a tough couple of years in a very, very poor Ducks team, playing with some not so great teammates at that time. But that is a haul if you could get a first-round pick and a top prospect for Josh Manson.
Yeah, I mean, I think, honestly, that reflects the value that the organization, like, kind of has, like, the esteem that they hold him in. Like, I think they definitely do see him as someone that they shouldn't trade away unless it's undeniably worth it, right? You know, like, there are players who you can make a marginal trade for or an iffy trade and be like, you know what? We'll take it. It's something to help us go going forward or whatever. I think with them, they would be just as happy, like you said, keeping him for the rest of his career as they would, you know, not doing anything at all. So, like, I think that's going to be the price. I think the thing to remember is Josh Manson has a 12-team no trade clause. So it'll be interesting to see how all of that kind of factors in. You know, when the Dubois rumors were coming out, we did hear that Henrik had Columbus on his list. I do wonder if that was maybe from Henrik's camp, as far as kind of trying to just get his name out of the rumors that I think people in Anaheim and around the league maybe had, as far as Henrik being someone who could contribute to a winning, a competing team, and, you know, had a contract and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, he had the no trade clause. I think you said it exactly right. Right. The other thing is that none of this is new information. The only thing that's changed is how close we are to the deadline. You know, I think they are two assets that fit a couple of different things, right? They fit that kind of Blake Coleman thing, which has come up, and Barkley Gaudreau thing, which has come up, as far as, like, they have that extra year. They're both players who people around the league have seen play at a very high level, and they fit roles that every team is looking to add. You can never have too many good defensemen, and you can never have too many guys who can score goals. So everything about them is attractive. The complicating factors are two things. They are their contracts a little too high given the flat cap and the lost revenue and internal budgets that teams might be operating on because of the uncertain finances going forward? And the other thing is Anaheim movable on its price? Because if it's you match our price or nothing, then I don't know that there's much, I don't know how much someone else is going to be willing to like engage with them, I think is the way I want to say it. But if they're willing to come down, then there's a better than not chance that we probably see at least one of them get moved before Monday.
Yeah, I think for Ricard Rocal, it hinges on how the recovery from his injury is going at this point. I know we got an update earlier today that he's kind of getting back into training and practice and ramping things up a bit, and then hopefully he'll be back soon. And, you know, obviously that bodes well, you know, for his perspective trade that could take place before the trade deadline. But yeah, Josh Manson is again another interesting one. Only makes $4.1 million for this year and next. It's an easy contract where you could retain, you know, upwards of 50% on it, and it doesn't hurt you too much. You know, it barely hurts you at all for this year because of the reduced salaries being this far into the season. And, you know, $2 million next year, especially with Getzlaf's $8 million coming off the books and Corey Perry's buyout not really hitting you that hard. If reducing it by, you know, retaining 50% gets you that extra piece that you want, or a second turns into a first, or a, you know, a B prospect turns into an A prospect, it's worth it at that point. And it invites more teams into, you know, the trade market for Josh Manson. Teams that are up against the cap, maybe teams like Toronto, and not just the teams that have an abundance of cap space like Carolina, or, you know, potentially like Winnipeg if they move some contracts out. But I do think those are two of the best fits for him. So it is not surprising to me that you know, those two teams are interested in. And obviously, you know, if the price is pretty high, I know a lot of people are looking at Cole Perfetti from the Winnipeg Jets, which that'd be a tough one to get done just because of how valuable he is and the fact that the Jets just drafted him. Now, I don't think he was their number one choice at that spot, but he fell to them at that spot and they just had to take him. But outside of Cole Perfetti, they've got Ville Heinola, who's kind of their second best prospect, and it drops off a little bit there. I know in the Eric Stevens article we referenced on the last show, there was a trade in there that featured a 2021 first in Kristen Vesalainen, who's a former first round pick of the Winnipeg Jets as well, which is a deal that I could see maybe more likely happening. You know, Heinola is a defenseman. I don't think the Jets are really in a position to give up a young defenseman. I don't think they want to give up Cole Perfetti for, you know, a year and a half of Josh Manson. So at that point, I think Kristen Vesalainen becomes the next best option. And if you're getting a first-round pick from the Jets, it's not the worst deal that you could get for Josh Manson. I think it fits kind of around the price they're looking for if they're looking for a first-round pick and a top prospect. And it fits the bill of the type of player the Ducks are looking for, not a guy who is, you know, 17 or 18, but I believe Vesalainen is 20, if not 21. And, you know, he's just kind of breaking his way into being a regular NHL player at this point, and potentially given a increased role in a young Ducks lineup, he kind of adds to that young core that they're building. So, I, you know, that could be one I see more likely. As much as everybody would love to get Cole Perfetti in return for Josh Manson, you would have to think they would have to add to that deal, especially if you're getting a first round pick as well.
Well, I think it's interesting, right? Because the one thing that we always kind of lose sight of, I think, and it's very easy to, when we talk about trades, is the context of both teams. Blake Wheeler's on a big contract, and he has not had a good year. I think he's certainly capable of performing at a level that gets closer to justifying that contract. But I also think if you win a Stanley Cup, it doesn't matter. I don't think anybody cares about that contract if in the first couple of years you win a Stanley Cup. And so they've got Mark Scheifele, who I think is already 26 or 27. They just added Pierre-Luc Dubois, who's only 21. You know, they've got a good young forward group with guys at kind of all the right age points. I don't know that I would let Cole Perfetti stop me from adding someone that was a difference maker, especially if I thought I could keep them going forward. Because, you know, two kicks at the can with Josh Manson in that top four, I think that's really big. You know, if you're looking at a Josh Morrissey and Josh Manson kind of top line, and then like Neil Pionk and somebody else on your second pair, you know, I think you're in a good spot. And again, they've got Connor Hellebuck, who, you know, we've seen goalies just form, that your form just drops off overnight sometimes, you know. And so I do wonder how much they may actually be pressing. I think Winnipeg makes a lot of sense for all parties involved. I just wonder if Manson would want to go there. You know, I think they would probably be on his list. And so unless there's maybe a kind of handshake deal that as soon as he's able to get an extension, they're going to sign him to a big one, protect him in the expansion draft, all that kind of stuff, that's the part of it that we're going to have to wait and see. Carolina being the other one makes sense. I think the fact that there's only really two teams out there does make me a little anxious that there, it's less likely for a deal to get done, because again, he seems like the type of player plenty of teams could be adding or should be interested in adding. And if there's only really two, and one of them really is the only one that's a legit contender as of right now, I wonder how much the market is really there. You know, I do wonder if the trade deadline is going to be a dud this year just by happenstance.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting trade deadline, because I feel like, you know, there's a lot of teams who are going to be pressured or feel like they're pressured in to add that piece. Teams maybe like the Florida Panthers, who are just playing exceptionally well this year, but I don't know if it's sustainable for an 82-game season, right? And this might be, you know, with the Panthers, they could be sitting here saying, okay, well, we gotta push for this now. Like, we got a chance to win this year. We've got some young assets that are not really doing anything for us right now. And to bring in a player, potentially Josh Manson, to replace Aaron Ekblad, who's down for the year, maybe this is, you know, our chance to go for it here. And, you know, I know in Eric Stevens' article, there was a fan proposed trade of Grigory Denisenko and a second round pick from 2021. There was a mention in there of potentially trying to increase that to Owen Tippett in the Panthers' first rounder, depending on how desperate they are. I think if you were trying to do a deal with Florida, you got to play in on that desperation of them losing Aaron Ekblad and not really having too many options to replace him at this point in time. And they could be a team, again, that have the cap space to get things done that would like, you know, 2 years or a year and a half of Josh Manson. And you know, having him again next year, even when Aaron Ekblad does come back, and having that kind of stronger defense core to rely on, and maybe a right side of Ekblad, Manson, and Mackenzie Weegar, which is, you know, a pretty formidable right side of defense to roll out there on a nightly basis. So that could be another team that kind of gets thrown into the discussion. Of course, I got to mention the Philadelphia Flyers too on our trade. It was our Who Says No Patreon bonus episode that we put out. That was one of both of our favorite trades that we ended up putting together. Was I don't remember the full details of it, but it was Josh Manson, Ryan Miller, and I think a Ducks third to the Flyers for Cam York.
It's like Scott Laughton or something like that.
Yeah, Cam York, a conditional first. And I think Justin Braun was the additional piece to make the cap work there. And Josh Manson was 50% retained in that deal. So that would be, I mean, that's still one I love. Just again, maybe for the fact that it's Anaheim Hills native and Cam York, they get to come home and play with the Ducks, and you get a conditional first that could be a pretty good pick if the Flyers don't make the playoffs, and could end up being 2022. And then Justin Braun comes in to fill Josh Manson's hole this year on defense, and then makes the cap work for Philadelphia for this year and next. So there's a lot of options out there. I don't, you know, it just all depends at the end of the day, with all the factors going into this year's trade deadline, how interested and how desperate our team's going to be to add Josh Manson. Because whatever team adds him is going to need to protect him in the expansion draft. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of throws a wrench into a lot of teams' plans, and really throws a wrench into the number of suitors that would be after Josh Manson. And then you still got to get through his no trade team list as well, and make sure that of the remaining interested parties, are any of them on that list of teams he's not willing to go to?
Yeah, I really think, you know, I really do think that it's as simple as like Raquel and Manson are perfect guys to add at the deadline. They are exactly the type of player that you can just drop in your lineup and they're going to do their thing. It might take them a couple of games to, you know, find their footing as far as chemistry with their line mates and things like that. But they're not players where you worry that changing their situation is volatile. They're consistent players and they're impact players on good teams. But like you said, you've got the expansion draft, you've got the flat cap, you've got the finances as far as just lost revenue. You know, as much as we talk about the flat cap, there's also just like the actual cash out that the, you know, the organization is paying and payroll and salaries and different things like that. So, you know, I think it really does come down to how many teams think they have a legitimate shot and how many of those teams want to invest in that shot. You know, I mean, we were talking about this earlier. Eric Johnson only played 4 games this year. You know, he's got 2 more years left at $6 million on the contract he's on. And, you know, I mean, there's no reason to think that turning that into Josh Manson doesn't make a ton of sense and do wonders of good for Colorado going forward. The problem with that is they've got Cale Makar and Sam Girard and what do you call it? Devin Taves. And they've got plenty of players that they're going to have to worry about protecting when everything comes up. And they've got a ton of forwards, so it's not like they can go 8. You know, so it's just there's so many outside factors that it is going to take someone to just say, screw it, I want to win a cup, and to make that first move. And maybe if somebody makes the first move, then that starts a little bit of a chain reaction. But if that move happens too late, then it could be, you know, one team makes one move and a couple teams make a couple small moves and nothing really changes all over as far as the balance of power. You know, I think we did talk about this before, I think, but the shortening the quarantine from 14 to 7 days for U.S. to Canada is huge. That should help a little bit, especially given how weird the North is right now. Like, all of a sudden, Winnipeg's second and, you know, Edmonton's in third and stuff like that. Like, this is one of those situations where it just, it feels like there are too many excuses readily available for GMs to not do something that I do wonder if they're not just, if it's not a thing. You know, I really do wonder how much GMs are all just going to sit on their hands and wait to get to the expansion draft before they start trying to really make some changes to their roster.
Well, yeah, we're only 5 days out from Monday's trade deadline, which I think is surprising how quickly it's kind of come up upon us at this point. And, you know, the only real kind of news or signs of impending trades have been 2 players that have been held out of the lineup. When Kyle Palmieri for the Devils has been held out of the lineup, with the chances of him being traded fairly likely. And then just today, Taylor Hall was held out of the Buffalo Sabres lineup for the exact same reason. And when you look at Rickard Rakell again, like, those are the 2 other big names in the market of guys who are likely going to get moved. Both of them are unrestricted free agents at the end of this season, so they are pure rentals. And, you know, with those guys being held out and likely to be moved, you would have to think like that it's one of them who are going to be the big domino who's going to fall first. And at least on the forward side of things, you're going to start to see other teams get desperate and these guys start going here. So whether it's Palmieri who ends up going first or Taylor Hall who goes first, then you'll start to see Rickard Rakell's name kind of shoot up the top of people's list in terms of players available. And if you're the Ducks, you got to try and take advantage of that, because there's going to be only so many buyers, you know, for this interesting trade deadline. And with Rickard Rakell being kind of the interesting case of having such a friendly cap hit and then being on your roster for next season, he kind of provides maybe a different option out there on the market than, say, what a Taylor Hall or a Kyle Palmieri brings to your team as just a real kind of pure rental. And honestly, this might be the only year that we see pure rentals being more enticing to teams than the 2-year contract or the next year that Ricard Raquel has just because of the impending expansion draft where, you know, you bring in Kyle Palmieri, you tell a team, you know, he's not only a rental, but he is 100% a rental because we're not going to try and re-sign him because then we could lose him to Seattle.
Pro teams have millions to spend and they don't always spend them wisely. But when it comes to a great shave, you don't have to shell out tons of cash. Harry's saw customers getting ripped off by the shaving industry with overpriced, underperforming products and decided to do something better. They found their own way to make beautifully designed razors for a fraction of the price of the other big brands, so you never wonder if you overpaid. Harry's shaving products look great, and the weighted handle makes shaving feel great too. I like to keep my beard neat, and Harry's always leaves me with a smooth yet crisp shave. Harry's quality is top-notch, thanks to German-engineered blades made in their own factory that stay sharp longer. You can get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. And Harry's has the highest customer satisfaction in the shaving industry, plus a convenient subscription option that you can cancel at any time. Getting the best doesn't mean spending the most when you shave with Harry's. Get started with a $13 trial set for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. That's harrys.com/bluewire for a $3 trial set.
So he's coming in and we're literally just renting him for a playoff run. And I think that's where you might see teams like Colorado and teams like Minnesota go that route and be a bit more desperate to bring in a rental rather than bringing in Ricard Raquel. And then it kind of leaves those teams who have that extra spot open in expansion draft who could then take a stab at Ricard Raquel as maybe their best option. So I think the market is still out there for guys like Ricard Raquel and Josh Manson. Just the number of teams, I think, drastically goes down because of their contract situation, because of teams having to get ready and prepare for the Seattle expansion draft.
The economy is made up of real people doing real stuff, and it affects everything. Which you obviously know since you're a real person doing real stuff. Marketplace is here to help you get smart about everything beyond the what of the day's business and economic news. We dig into the how and the why with the real people driving our economy. From big tech and interest rates to small businesses and what's happening at the Fed, Marketplace breaks it all down so you don't have to. Listen to Marketplace wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I think we could go through the entire league, right? And we could say pretty quickly off the top of our head which one of them would fit, and we could probably put one of them on every team, you know, maybe with the exception of the bottom couple of teams, Buffalo, Ottawa, Detroit, and things like that. But, I mean, any team, realistically, with even an outside shot of making the playoffs, like, they would be welcome additions. Again, the question is just going to be is how eager are GMs and owners going to be to make these types of decisions when there's kind of so much safety built into not trying to do things that you might, this might be the only year you can really get away with not being a big buyer, just based on everything going on and the expansion draft and all that kind of stuff. The other thing I think is interesting, and I've heard I think it was Merrick say this on 31 Thoughts, was he made the comment that, you know, draft picks just aren't the most valuable this year because, one, there's not a ton of footage or exposure. You know, the minor league guys or the juniors, geez Louise, you know, those guys just aren't playing right now. Or if they are, they're playing in weird spots and out of order. And there's all these things going on that is going to make, you know, trying to scout some of these guys difficult, on top of the fact that this isn't a draft with a super clear, top of the draft. I think it seems to be a couple of names at the top that everybody kind of agrees on, but I don't think there's a clear cut number one. I think I saw something that, like, there are like 5 different guys that you could easily talk into going number one. So, like, it's weird to me that in a year where maybe teams would be more interested, especially some of those middle teams, in getting out from under those picks to bring in difference makers for a run, it's disincentivized just because of the rest of the context. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, which way that kind of goes as far as will we see teams be more conservative, or will we see teams start to make concessions with each other in order to get some of these trades and try to get some of these assets? You know, do we see more an increase in conditional picks? Do we see an increase in retained salary, things like that? The little stuff that you can do to help kind of grease the wheels a little bit. I'll be curious to see if that comes into play in the week leading up to the draft or the trade deadline.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if it's a buyer's or seller's market, you know, in terms of the prices paid for some of these guys and what, you know, Kyle Palmieri and a Taylor Hall and potentially Ricard Raquel and Josh Manson are going to fetch on the open market, and whether, you know, that many teams are going to be interested. It could potentially, like we said, be a tough market to sell in, with only a few teams really interested in adding some of these long-term pieces, or it could be a very tough market to buy in, with a lot of these guys getting snapped up and teams trying to make a run at a shortened season and potentially an easier route to a Stanley Cup than they would normally have in a full 82-game season with the regular division. So it is going to be interesting to see how they approach this. And we're only 5 days away, and we really haven't had, you know, really any rumblings, which is odd for a trade deadline to be 5 days out. And, and you see, you know, two high profile names get held out of the lineup finally, but really no deals that have gone through. Like, I think league wide, the last trade to be made was the Alexander Volkov trade. I don't think we've had another trade since then. So, you know, where we are kind of a couple of days away here from potentially some of the bigger names getting moved. But, it's going to be a really interesting time to be an Anaheim Ducks fan and see how they approach this deadline, because it's a unique one, to say the least. But one guy who I think we can firmly scratch off the trade list is Ryan Getzlaf. I don't think he's a guy that's going to get moved at the deadline, but we did get some reports about Ryan Getzlaf and his future with the team in a different way, where Frank Cervelli on the DFL podcast said that he's going to throw this at you. You wouldn't be totally shocked if Ryan Getzlaf retired after this season. I know this is something we've kind of briefly discussed before. We all kind of expected Ryan Getzlaf to sign another contract after this, even if it was a one-year deal, and come back no matter what. It is kind of an interesting twist in the saga here, hearing, you know, somebody else, somebody high up at least, you know, among hockey minds, speculate about Ryan Getzlaf thinking about retirement. Now, this could just simply be Cervelli's opinion. And, you know, he thinks the way the Ducks are playing and no direction kind of in sight of them being a better team, that Ryan Getzlaf could just call it quits and doesn't want to go to another team. Or this could be him actually having some inside information, you know, from Ryan Getzlaf camp or from the Ducks, where Ryan Getzlaf is actually considering retiring and calling it quits. So, it opens up the discussion, because I think it is definitely possible, right? I don't think it's out of the question to say that Getzlaf could just take, you know, contract expires. He's been with the organization for his entire career, and he hangs it up and turns it over to the kids. I honestly think it's becoming increasingly, maybe not more likely, but getting closer to 50% in terms of whether he's going to be back next year or not.
Yeah, Yeah, it's weird, right? Because he's at the point in his career now where, more than anything, it's going to be about how much he wants to put in the work physically, you know, in the off season, to ensure that his body is able to make it through the rigors of a full NHL season. You know, I don't think any of his skills, you know, he's not a speed player, he's not a skating agility player. There's nothing he's good at that doesn't allow him to age well, I think. It really is just going to be, is he there mentally and is he there physically? And those are just things we don't know. You know, he's never really made any comments about those. Every time we hear, it's just, yeah, that's something me and Bob have been talking about. And, you know, we've kind of had those conversations ongoing, but right now I'm just kind of focused on this. And you're like, oh, okay, cool. You know, I it definitely did seem like Cervelli was kind of just spitballing, but at the same time, you know, sometimes that spitballing is based on a rumor and you're looking to get something else to kind of pop somewhere else to confirm it. So it'll be it'll be interesting. I would say that I think it's 65, 70, you know, like 70% that he's back next season. But, you know, if they're not able to move on from like Henrique, it becomes a question of what kind of options do they have going forward? Where can Getzlaf stay in the lineup? Because he's obviously going to be a center. You know, I know Patrick Marleau was a center at one time and he moved to wing, and that works because of his skill and his speed and things like that. Like, Getzlaf's just, that's not his game. He's always going to be a center. And so it'll be kind of about how much him and the team have a fit as far as him coming around. You know, it sounds silly, but it really just, so much of this just has kind of come down to what Getzlaf wants to do. And we just don't have any kind of insight into that with him. We know he likes it here. We know he wants to stick around. He hasn't said anything about wanting to get traded publicly or anything like that. He's kind of alluded to the opposite multiple times, but anything could change, because at the end of the day, he's a human and his mind could change at any moment. And maybe if he does decide to retire, he does open up to getting traded at the deadline, right? Well, screw it. I'm going to be done this summer anyways. Let's take one more shot. I have no idea. And, you know, it's an interesting thought, but I don't know how much there is as far as things to go on from a planning perspective, because of the number of things that could affect that decision for both sides.
Yeah, it feels like an easy opinion to have from the outside looking in. And obviously Frank Cervelli is way more connected than any of us are. And there could be some substantiated evidence behind his claims that he thinks Ryan Getzlaf is going to retire. And you know, whether he has that inside information or not will be something we'll probably never know. But it does just seem like, you know, if you asked anybody, I think from the outside looking in, looking at how bad the Ducks are this year, looking at their record, Ryan Getzlaf's age, the fact that his contract is expiring at the end of the year, I think it's a pretty safe, you know, assumption to think that he could want to retire at the end of this season. I don't think anybody would blame him for doing so and calling it quits. But I think, you know, for us who've been watching this team all year, watching Ryan Getzlaf all year, looking at the all access that the Ducks put out earlier today, where it was kind of a pretty big Ryan Getzlaf focus, where they talked to him about the young kids coming in and the new direction of the organization. And it seemed like a guy who wants to stick around and expects to be here for, you know, at least another couple of years. You know, he did make a mention in that video that the Ducks put out that, you know, whether that's with him or without him, he wants to see this organization do well. So you can read into that, you know, as much as you want. But, you know, I would kind of lean in the same direction you are there in that it's, you know, 70 to 75% that he's going to be coming back, at least for next year, on a one-year deal, if not more. And then, you know, from there, it remains to be seen. You know, it's probably, you know, one-year deals or at most, you know, a two-year deal. And then they keep doing one-year deals like Joe Thornton did with the Sharks and then, you know, seeing how things go from there. But Ryan Getzlaf, to me, isn't too much different than Joe Thornton in terms of his ability right now and his ability to make an impact. And, you know, Jumbo Joe's playing over 40 right now, so I wouldn't be surprised for Getzlaf to shock everybody and play, you know, another 4 years in the league. It all depends if that's what he wants to do, right? And that's what it comes down to at the end of the day, is how much longer does this guy want to play in the league? How much longer does he want to stick around with this organization? And when's that all going to kind of come to a head and a decision is going to be made? So, you know, at the very least, it would be nice to see him hit 1,000 and get to that marker and kind of have that as his swan song and call it quits there. You know, I'm sure he wants to hit that, and I can't see him as, you know, as competitive as he is to end his career early with a chance to hit that if he came back, let's say, next year for a full 82-game season, right? Like, it, you might as well And I think he'd make the same argument. He might as well just come back for that year, similar to Ryan Miller. Might as well just come back, break a few records, or hit a few milestones you want to hit.
Just pass Dominic Hasek, no big deal.
Yeah, and then, you know, if you want to call it quits after that, then you've kind of done all you came out to accomplish, right? You've hit those milestones you wanted to hit. And I'm sure that's an important marker for Ryan Getzlaff in his career to hit that number. And I can't imagine him giving that up to allow some of the younger kids to come in. It's maybe as selfish as that sounds. This is a guy who's given everything for this organization. I think he deserves to be able to come back and hit that milestone if that's something he wants to do.
Yeah, no, I agree. Here's my question. Do you think his coming back is directly tied to Henrique being on this team next year? Because, and I'm not trying to be funny or melodramatic, but you've got Zegras, who they're moving to center, and Lundestrom, who plays center. That's two already. Then you figure they're probably going to keep trying Steele unless they trade him. They've got Derek Grant, who they seem, you know, one, he's got the two more years left on his deal, and they want him, and, you know, they seem invested in keeping him around. And then on top of that, if Getzlaff comes back, and I'm just wondering, you know, are they going to move Henrique to the wing again? Is that something that they want to do for a guy that they're paying almost $6 million a year to be a middle six center? You know, I wonder how much their ability to move Henrique out will have an effect on Getzlaff coming back, just based on the roster construction and the lineup, what it can look like.
Yeah, the Zegras moving to center situation does kind of create, I don't want to say an unintended logjam, but adds to the logjam at center that the Ducks already have, that they say that Zegras is going to play center, and when he plays for the Ducks again, he's going to be a center, and mm-hmm. they're committed to that. And again, it speaks to the Ducks' history of when they are committed to playing guys at center, they will play them at center until it's proven it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So it seems like Trevor Zegras is, at least, you know, short-term future with the Ducks for right now, is going to be as a centerman. So that takes up a spot. And Isaac Lindstrom, as much as he's moved to the wing occasionally, I think they want him down the middle of the ice. I think the same can be said for Sam Steele, even though he's moved to the wing before. And if Ryan Getzlaff comes back, I don't think he's coming back to play in the wing. And not that I don't think he'd be receptive to the idea. I just think, you know, his value to this team is down the middle of the ice. I don't know if his value is as high playing as a winger, and that's something he really hasn't done before. And then it comes down to Adam Henrique as well. But then you've got five names, right? You've got Henrique, Getzlaff, Lindstrom, Steele, and Zegras that have to fill spots, and Derek Grant. And I don't think you want any of those first five names playing as a fourth line center. So then you've got, you know, five names for three spots. And that's where you have to start making decisions of shifting guys to the wing and whatnot if you're bringing all of them back. I think best case scenario, you find a way to move on from Adam Henrique, hope somebody will give you something for him, whether it's a second round pick or first round pick or whatever, maybe a retained salary at that point, and just move on and get some assets in return from him and see what you can do at that point. I think that's the best case. But obviously, you know, another option is something like you mentioned, that if Getzlaff is really considering retirement, maybe he calls it quits here for the betterment of some of these young kids to step in. And I don't think that's an impossible situation. I think that's one where if Ryan Getzlaff was considering retirement, I think that would be one reason he would step aside, is for the betterment of the organization, because that's something we've heard from him numerous times in the past.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. I think he's definitely shown that willingness and that awareness of wanting to never feel like his presence is hindering, you know, the team from being successful. I think, you know, what's funny is I still think that it's probably best to move out two of the guys who should be playing center for them. You know, I think in a perfect world, you're moving out Grant and Henrique. But even if it's Henrique and Steele, I think that's probably, you know, I think that's probably good. Like, I do wonder if they're, isn't approaching a point where I think we've talked about this before, as far as you just hate, damn it. You get to a point where you want to move on from a guy before the rest of the league has kind of caught on to that maybe he's not what he's rumored to be or supposed to be. And I wonder if Sam Steele is getting to that point where Anaheim needs to take a real long, hard look at moving on and allowing him kind of a reset, but also getting something back for a player that still has some value in the eyes of people around the league. You know, I don't mean to sound super down on Sam Steele. I certainly think he's still early in his career, but I think we are really starting to see Anaheim's lineup take shape in front of us. And, you know, there's going to have to be questions answered and asked and answered at a certain point. And so you wonder if moving out a guy like Steele now helps to kind of solve some of those problems going forward.
Yeah, you're not realistically going to be able to keep all these guys around. And I think that's what people are starting to realize. And like you said, the roster is starting to take shape. And when you look at the future centers of this team, it's looking like Zegras, Lindstrom, maybe one of Getzlaff and Henrique for the short term. And in the long term, you know, another center you take out of the draft. And, you know, Sam Steele's starting to fall down the pecking order here. I think, you know, on the wing, you're starting to get a better picture now of Comtois and Jones and Terry and these guys stepping up and, you know, sprinkle in a few veterans here and there as well. Silverberg, if he's still around. Ricard Raquel, if he doesn't end up getting traded and sticks around as well. And all of a sudden, you do have a roster taking shape. But at some point, yeah, so some of these guys are going to move on. It's the reality of kind of building a team. There's really only 9 spots on a forward group, at least 9 prime spots for these guys to really be high-profile, offensive players who contribute to the production of this team. So, Sam Steele's kind of wasted, I think, as a fourth line player, and we've seen him there occasionally throughout this season. So it'll be interesting to see the direction they go. I would love to see the guys stick around, but you are right. It is getting to a point where, you know, they've got to kind of decide what they want to do with him and a few other guys, and it might be time to move on. But let's wrap up the show with just kind of a little bit of housekeeping here, a few extra tidbits of news surrounding the Ducks. So they did put up a few injury updates, I think, the other day, where they said that Ryan Getzlaff didn't practice. This was for, I believe, Monday. He didn't practice, as dealing with an upper body injury right now. Ricard Raquel is also dealing with an upper body injury, skated on his own, and is inching closer to a return. And Sonny Milano, who is listed as an upper body, but I believe we all assume that's a concussion at this point, practiced with the team in a non-contact jersey. So his return is basically whenever he gets cleared safely to come back and play. And then the aforementioned Sam Steele, who's dealing with a lower body injury, did not skate. So, you know, a few guys inching closer to return. I think Ricard Raquel is probably the closest of all of them in getting back to action. And if you're looking for him to get traded at the deadline, that's probably music to your ears for this one. But again, you know, we didn't talk too much of the game here, but Ducks win 5-1, a nice, fun win against a rival team. Some good performances from the likes of Max Jones, Isaac Lindstrom, Troy Terry, Josh Manson, Adam Henrique, John Gibson. I think the list goes on. It was a good night for a lot of Ducks players tonight. Sam Carrick with back-to-back fights, and, you know, clearly a guy who is trying to find a way to stick up with the NHL roster. And I've been pretty impressed with his play as of late. But we'll be back, I believe, not for Friday's game. We've got a few Patreon shows coming up for the weekend. So we've kind of got some other priorities in terms of recording, but we do, or you do, Stephen, at least have a few interviews that you've put together. I know you just recorded one the other day, so we might be releasing that for either Thursday or Friday to kind of make up for not having a post-game show after Friday. And then Stephen and I will also be sitting down at some point here, either before the trade deadline or after, with Josh Bell, who currently works for FC Hockey, or prior to that worked for the Hockey Writers, where Stephen and I both did some writing for the Ducks in the past. And he's pretty in tune with the draft, is definitely a guy you could call a draft guru. So we'll be getting a very early look at who the Ducks could get with their potential top 5 pick in the 2021 NHL entry draft, and what types of players they could add to the list of Trevor Zegras and Jamie Drysdale and really pushing this rebuild to the next level. So that will be a fun conversation to have. Stephen, I'll let you kind of speak quickly to the interview that that you recently did and what to look forward to there.
Yeah, I sat down with Chris Watkins on Twitter. He's Yellow Pinato, DJ Bodega Cat. I just think he's a really smart guy. He has a very, you know, kind of non-traditional viewpoint on hockey. We talked about analytics and about trying to, you know, how to, like, what does analytic hockey look like? What are certain things that you can do to try to, you know, maximize your roster, maximize your window? How we talked a little bit at the end about, you know, the context determines the value of your assets and things like that. So it was kind of a weird, nebulous conversation. We talked about a lot of different things, but it was a really good conversation. And yeah, we'll be getting that out hopefully Thursday, maybe Friday, as kind of a what do you call it? Like an olive branch for not having the Friday show. So it was great. And, you know, we're going to sit down with Josh. And then I know there's some other stuff we want to try to maybe get done. And we've got Pucks and Brews on Sunday, like you said. So it should be good. It'll be a fun little bit of stretch here. So,
yeah, hopefully provide you guys some, you know, some exciting and friendly content heading into the weekend again with two tough games against probably the hottest team in the NHL in the Colorado Avalanche. So probably a good thing we're not going live after that Friday game. It's bound to be a tough one against the Avalanche. And then obviously Sunday and Monday, there's two games, and we always go live after the second game of the back-to-back. So in terms of the return for the post-game show, it looks like we're aiming for Monday, April 12th, which is trade deadline day. So we could have some big news that we're wrapping up and discussing revolving the Ducks, and maybe not even just the Ducks, around some of the other big names that get moved on that day. So we'll treat that day as obviously a kind of summation of the three Ducks games that we missed over that period of time, but also a bit of a trade deadline recap in terms of some of the big deals and hopefully some of the deals surrounding the Ducks. So as Stephen mentioned too, if you are a Patreon listener, stay tuned and stick around for a bit of a primer before Sunday's game. We'll be recording Pucks and Brews, which is always a blast. It'll be fun kind of recording that just before the Avalanche game on Sunday. So if you're a Patreon member, look out for that. If you're not, head over to patreon.com/forevermighty and check out some of the bonus content we put out there. It's always a lot of fun to kind of sit back and obviously talk the Ducks, but also some of the big news around the NHL as well. So we'll see you guys as a kind of a whole group here after Monday night against the Sharks games. Appreciate everybody who came out live, and hope you guys all have a great weekend. Take care.
Night, everybody.